Hello, welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm chuffed to have Peter Carey with us this evening. And we're going to be dragging him down the corridor of time to talk about his 1988 novel Oscar and Lucinda, which he was published and won the Booker Prize in 1988. Hardly seems possible so long ago, but it was. I've got my sort of clever questions, but I was thinking about it, and I thought maybe I should stick those in the background for a bit and start with what I think those readers, those fans, were saying, and sort of, I suppose, ask you a bit about the love story to start with. Yeah?
This is the wrong way to go.
Is this the wrong way to go? I should be asking you about... I should be doing chronology. I should be doing prolepsis. Yes, yes, no, no. I'm going to ask about the love story, okay? It's a love story where they don't meet for half the book.
When I began to write, there was no love story. There was no Oscar and there was no Lucinda. And there were a whole lot of sort of ideas and all of those sort of things. So the fact that there is finally a love story really is because... you have the person who's going to be the clergyman and somehow or other is going to be a member of the Anglican Church and be a rebel at the same time. I'm sure it happens all the time here. I'm just an outsider, I'm sorry. And this person who turns out finally to be a woman who inherits a glass. And the whole thing in the end for it to work, in terms of notes I made at the very... very, very early in the book, was that the relationship would never be consummated.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's all. So all these things are sort of like they're like diagrams, right? So the fact that in the end it's a love story and that people feel about the characters is something that's produced in the end in following the consequences of the diagram.
And the fact that you decided, and it's interesting you say, the one thing you said about their relationship that you sort of knew in advance was it was not going to be consummated.
And he was going to die, and he was going to drown in the river. So all of these things, if I had known him when I decided that, clearly I could never have done it to him. But so... I don't know what this really does with the question. I think it screws it up a little bit.
Can we do the non-consummation? Because, I said foolishly to some people recently, some radio people, all the best love stories in fiction are unconsummated. Mm. Oh, what? Mm. I mean, you say, Wuthering Heights, and then you say, Tessa the D'Urbervilles, and they say, no, she has sex, not with the one she loves. And then Sorrows of Young Werther, lots of... A Month in the Country, have you ever read that?
No, I haven't.
Joel Cole, fantastic. Why is it important that they don't...
Well, I don't know that it is important. It's just that that's how it came about. And I was... rather irrationally, I had this vision of Oscar, who was the never-to-be-known narrator's grandfather, or great-grandfather, I can't remember, like an old salmon swimming upstream and sort of being all furious and red and going upstream to die. And, of course, logically that makes no sense because he wasn't from there, so he's not a fish returning to his home or any of those things. But when I write at the beginning, I'm often just sort of trying things out, winging things out, trying to see what things feel like, and that sort of notion of him coming up the Bellinger River to die was sort of powerful for me for some reason I probably still don't understand. And what became important as I started to know the characters and understood that a bet had been made that he was going to undertake this sort of journey for her. That it had to really be based on a whole series of misunderstandings, and in which, consummation would possibly, and this is testing my memory. I forgot my PIN number the other day. So embarrassing. I had to go back to the apartment and look it up, where it written in the Oxford Dictionary.
this is podcast too. the nation and the world.
But it's under a very funny word.
Right. Okay.
Anyway. So where were we?
So where were you? Yes, what you might have forgotten about the novel.
Yeah, a lot, many, many, many things. I mean, and one, and over the years, in the course of 20 years, say, and you start to be a very bad witness to your own work, and you get used to saying something, and then you repeat what it is that you said last time. Which probably wasn't true even then. The salmon really, really was a big part of it. The notion, and all of I had to just keep stopping them doing it.
Well, you do. It's quite. I mean, this time round, and I boast, I've read it three times now, but that's over the course of, you know, quite a long time. And this time round, I really noticed more than I had, I think, on the previous two occasions, how determined to disappoint the romantic inclinations of the reader, that's one way of putting it, you were, because, okay, they don't consummate it, but they live together. They kiss, they press their bodies against each other. He even does propose marriage to her, but in the wrong way, which is guaranteed not to. She teetered all the time on the brink of sharing this thing, which is the fact that she loves it. So you're teetering and teetering, but you're just sort of determined make us feel how close they come, but they don't.
You know, I'm really not thinking at all. I never thought about the romantic expectations of the reader. I mean, how naive can you be? You do this sort of year after year, day after day, and how is it possible that I'm not thinking about this? Well, I really, really wasn't thinking about it. And that was a complete surprise to me, because all I was trying to do was make this sort of, I hoped, well-formed, interesting story where the people were alive. It's not that I wasn't sort of deeply, deeply emotionally involved with the characters, because I certainly was. And, I mean, you couldn't write that book and not be. But I didn't have any thought of romantic expectations on the reader's part. No.
And what about as we're on the ending, what about the surprise? You notice how frequently the narrator refers to Oscar as my great-grandfather. Mm. But who is his great-grandmother? Yeah. And what I didn't realise, actually you do say it on page 79.
I do?
Yeah, you do. That's really naughty. And I didn't notice. I don't think that.
I can't remember.
Can you remember doing that? Because all the time.
You mean in the order of teasing out the relationship between the narrator? Because that's there from the beginning.
Yes. No, I meant.
It's more who's the grandmother, you mean? Or
the great grandmother. It's like you slip in. What it felt like this time is that you actually slip in a little clue.
Yes.
Well, no, it's not a clue, it's a tell. It's actually a sort of... But in such a way that certainly when you're first reading it, you really would be an unusual reader who'd actually notice it.
Then. Well, I suppose a lot of the business of writing fiction anyway, is having this notion of sort of being running along relatively fast, throwing these balls up into the air and thinking, oh, my God, I forgot about this. And reading over the lines and checking for what information is missing and what if there's a crack there that you can put something in there which is going to help the whole. So that sounds to me now, although I don't remember it at all, it's just an example of that sort of continual reading of the sentences.
The ending also is kind of, I suppose, is extraordinary because of the thing I kind of kept back that I wanted to talk to you about, which is about the religion in the novel. Mm. There's one obvious place you went to for some of the stuff in the novel, which you mention in the acknowledgements, which is Edmund Gosse's father and son. I mean, it's a good place because I've read the blinking thing, you know. And his extraordinary memoir of his childhood with his Plymouth Brethren dad. Mm. I mean, why is that? Why was that such a sort of tempting source book for you?
Well, because I'd set myself something that was rather, without that, would be sort of impossible. Because one of the reasons that I wanted to write Oscar and Lucinda was, as you know, to do with a particular little church in the place that I was living. And the events surrounding this church. And I did think at that time, you know, if I have any culture at all, really, it's a Christian culture. And that I'm an atheist, but my work is full of, I know, of Christianity in all sorts of different ways. And so one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was to sort of look at a landscape from which a church was being removed and to look at the Christian stories that had replaced the Aboriginal stories. So I wanted Christian stories, and I wanted it to be the ones that I was raised as an Anglican. So it made sense to me that this thing that I thought of was rather boring, maybe I could do something with. And so then I needed my Anglican, Oscar, to be in rebellion against something, reading what's it called, Father and Son.
Yeah.
Provided, you know, I thought, oh my God, of course, this is what he's rebelled about against, and why not?
The interest of the novel in something that arguably novelists find quite difficult to accommodate in fiction, chance, luck, is made possible because of the religion in the book.
Well, the religion, I mean, it's sometimes when one's writing a book and making notes for a book, and in the process, when things start to come together, you know, you get a congregation of things, you know you're onto something interesting. And when I was seeking to justify this ridiculous thing of this church, which wasn't yet glass, on a barge going up a river in 19th century Australia, which for me was perfect because it was symbolically perfect. There was a box full of Christian stories going through a landscape filled with Aboriginal stories. And this suited me just fine. But it's a ludicrous thing. I mean, absolutely. And so then I sought to explain it in, firstly, by somebody might be maybe demonstrating a new technology. And I talked to a friend, an architect, who said, well, the Victorians, you know, did have, you know, cast iron for glass houses. And why do you want to know? And I told him. And he said, well, why don't you have a glass church? And I went, wow, thank you very much. That's great. We'll do that. It's an even more ludicrous thing. We've got a glass church now going on. And in my reaching out to try and justify this, I thought, well, why would it be? Well, maybe it was a bet. So then I think, bet. And then I remember Pascal, you know, that if you believe in God, it is a bet. And if you're right, well, it's fantastic. You get all eternity and everything. And if you're wrong, well, you had a good life anyway. You know, so then that's I remembered the whole business of the notion of throwing lots,
yeah,
as chance being an expression of, you know, God's will or whatever. And because, you know, this was going to be a book that was going to deal at least in some aspects with religion, I thought that I started to get very excited about that. So yes, yeah, it is. But the notion of, you know, the throwing of lots and Pascal and so on all fitted in with me trying to justify this rather cartoonish diagram.
It seems though that that's one of the reasons why, I mean, there are quite a few novels that have been in the last 20 or 30 years, quite a few novels with Victorian, 19th century characters and settings. And one of the important things about the religion in the 19th century religiosity in this seems to be that because of its importance to the plot, in a way, even the Plymouth Brethren stuff that the dad believes in, is respect the wrong word for it, that actually there's lots of theology in this novel, yeah, and the theology is something that actually binds the novel together, I felt. Not like some antiquarian peculiarity that we're invited to, as it were, be relieved to have escaped from.
No, that's funny. You use the word respect, right? Yeah. So in other words, the people are allowed to...
Yeah.
To have their beliefs, and so
they're
not there. Yes, yes, absolutely.
And also that I suppose I was thinking about something more sort of formal about the way the novel works, with all these accidents and chance occurrences, and you know, even down to my favourite character, Mr. Wardley Fish, and his encounter with Oscar because he knocks on the wrong door, and all that sort of, it all starts with a Christmas pudding. Those chains going back of inconsequential yet formative accidents. It does seem that if the giving the characters their peculiar religious outlooks is a way of sort of enabling you to do that, because they're constantly trying to see patterns, aren't they?
Yeah, but you know, well, we are too, of course, as readers. But you would probably find if you were dedicated and bored enough. If you look through my work, and you probably find that the role of chance and coincidence is quite high.
Yes.
And not, I hope, just because I'm a lazy writer, which I hope I'm not, but because I really think, you know, that is how life is, and that is how life works, and it doesn't seem to me to be odd. So what I'm saying is I would have been doing that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it certainly does fit, and it fits thematically, and it fits with the religion, and it fits with the gambling and so on. Yeah.
The most striking thing about the experience of reading the novel is something that always fascinates me, I suppose, about all novels, which is the chapters, really. The striking thing about how this novel is constructed, aside from the plot, the story, is that it's written in these 111, mostly really short, two or three page chapters, which are like sort of lots and lots of little fragments,
yeah,
it feels like.
Exactly.
I mean, what, why was that in an important way of doing it?
Well, you know, because it was the only way I knew how to do it, I suppose. I mean, it's not that I would have felt that I had a lot of other choices. It was a way that I could imagine doing it. And if you think of how I'm inventing the book, of course, I'm thinking absolutely about the ending and absolutely about the long curve of it, but I've really got to get to there, to there, to there, and each of those, I think, are like a tile, and the book is made like that, and I can't see very far ahead, and I will need the next thing to hold up the thing before and the thing to do, and I used to worry so much, you know. I can remember writing Oscar and Lucinda and sitting there looking at the length of these chapters. And there'd be books on the shelf, and every now and then I'd stand up and look through the books, looking for, I could find anybody whose chapters were ridiculously short. So it's just really, really, John, just, it's really all I knew how to do. And when I also thought of them like, I did think of them like tiles, and I did think of them like a sort of a mosaic.
Yes.
Where you make each, you try to make each tile sort of self-contained and beautiful and perfect, if you could. And then you fitted it next to another.
Something else that is perhaps a rather 19th century pleasure of your novel, which is unusual in novels of recent years, which is it's got quite a big cast of characters. And it's
how reckless.
And it's not just a numerical thing. You will go off with some of them sometimes. So you start noticing this quite early on. You get the Anglican vicar, Mr. and Mrs. Stratton, and you've been introduced to them, and their function in the narrative seems clear, and then you'll get a chapter which tells you about their courtship and marriage. And it has a purpose, and it tells you stuff about their preoccupation with money or the lack of money, which becomes very important. But it's also a kind of pleasurably almost excessive bit of, it's a tile, as you say, it's something that has an existence almost of its own, which I don't know, but chapters make possible. If you had longer chapters, it's almost as if you couldn't do that.
You're quite right. I think if you weren't about 40 years old, you would never dream of doing it either. I think probably in my first published novel, Bliss, that's considerably shorter, not as accomplished a book. But there's still this thing of looking at the story from the different point of view of characters. And and that when I needed to do something, I'd often go to the other character. And then when I got to the next novel, which was a hugely ridiculously ambitious book called Illywacker, I continued to do the same thing on a larger scale. So, in other words, looking at the action from different point of views and not being nervous about inventing a new character to do it. And I think that follows through into this book as a sort of a habit from there.
I'm going to give everybody here a chance. Just before I do, can I ask you about one more thing which interests me? Hair. The character's hair. There's lots and lots about their hair.
Really?
Yeah. They both have incredibly awkward hair, which gets talked about. I'm going to let somebody else ask a question.
Hi, Peter. I've almost finished it, and I just love it. For me, it's a novel very, very much about migration and about place and what that does. I mean, the beginning in Devon, you know, the London bit, and the Sydney in particular is terribly evocative for me. And I wondered where you were in your life at that point influenced the novel, and if so, how? Because in a way, I think left, didn't you, Australia in the sort of late 80s, and you know, you now live in New York, obviously. I'm very interested in people and place and what it does.
Well, the first thing is, of course, that like all writers, my personal life has absolutely nothing to do with my work. So that on a broader, I think it's impossible. Well, I've noticed in myself that if you are going to write about Australia, and you're going to write about Australia, you're going to think about, you know, if you are Australian, why you're there, how you're there, where you're there. You inevitably are going to, and for reasons to do with colonialism and reasons to do with everything, you're always going to end up thinking about two countries. Well, I have, anyway. And so, at the time, for me to write a book that was where I had to imagine Oxford University, which, believe me, was a very intimidating thought. And I knew I had to be able to imagine a lot of this country, which had existed in my life forever, but by people who didn't know it very well, like my grandfather, who would call England home. And, of course, he'd never been to England and never would. So, as for the landscape, I think, well, probably for all of us, well, although city dwellers, I guess, end up with a slightly different relationship to landscape, but people who are born outside of cities or in smaller towns and cities, we all feel really strongly about landscape. I mean, it's impossible, I think, to be human and not feel about landscape. But I think the landscape, the nature of a landscape in Australia is very particular. We do have this sense of... We would say we've got over this now, but, I mean, firstly, being a long way from Europe, where most of the white people who came to Australia came from. And we would be aware of the landscape's ability to kill us. And we would be aware that we were clustering on the coast. And we would also probably, if we had half a mind, sort of know that some other people had lived there for 50,000 years and actually had lived there rather well, and it hadn't really had such a tendency to kill them. So the notion of place and learning to love that place are really important to us, because also people of my age were brought up to really think the right landscape was here. And that when you saw where everything was green, that was the correct landscape, and where everything was brown was probably not the right landscape. But so there you are, I've avoided the personal. I plan to continue doing that.
At the back, yes, sir.
I just want to return to that broader question of sort of spareness and thrifty design that John mentioned earlier. And I wondered, I mean, it seems to be kind of like endemic at the moment, this push, or it has been for the last sort of 30 years, push towards minimalism and miniaturism. And I wonder, in terms of your creative writing teaching, is there any link between the values that you share or that you would promote for your students and then those that you would that you hold for your own work? Because it seems to me minimalism, or that idea of paring back Given that this is such an architectonic novel as well, we've been mentioning in terms of its formal design. Mm-hmm. You know, is that something that there is a kind of link between your creative writing pedagogy and your own creative values for your own fiction?
When I first began to teach creative writing at Wadsworth, it was just a sort of an American scam that would get me a green card. And that was because, and no one got any better, which seemed to prove it to me. And then, of course, I got a little bit better, and then the students started to get better, and then I saw actually there were things you could hand on. I think I'm there when I'm in a class. I'm really there to help them do what they want to do. And of course, if you put 12 people in a room, they all want to do different things. There is not in any room that I sit in a fashion or a way of doing things. And I suppose I've written unsuccessfully in many, many different ways and been influenced by lots of different people. So if there's some particularly weird prose that turns up in the workshop, it will probably not feel very alien to me. And so one's first job is to help the student do what they want to do. And then within all of this, I think there are such really simple sort of things that, you know, for students to think about. Like, what is the order in which you say things? What do you say first and what do you say second? And to get the class engaged in that as a specific issue has results. Also, writers, I think, as a group, tend to... we're very good on how we feel. You know, our feelings are pretty important to us. But generally speaking, I think we're not very good at looking. And looking at the world. So one of the things that, you know, I'd encourage students to do is to really think hard about physical space, the physicality of things, to realise that space is a character, and in terms of character, to understand that they've got clay for their character and that the shape of the person and, you know, all of those sort of things we deal with. And when I first started doing it, I used to get really pissed that I was wasting my time reading all this stuff when I should be reading great literature, and therefore my own personal growth was being impeded. Now I would really think, although I couldn't tell you exactly how, and it's what you're meant to say if you're a teacher, but I think I've really learnt an awful lot by having to think about the problems that my students are facing when they're quite different lots of work. So minimalism, I mean, there was a certain time, you know, maybe... You know, in the United States, but 15 years ago, when you knew the people had been influenced by Ray Carver because they put a Kmart in their story, you know, and that would be it. Really, it wouldn't be anything else. But you knew. But I have a writer, Chinese American writer called Bill Chang, who's in my class. I think is really, really good. He loves Ray Carver to death. He is a minimalist. He's a very, very good minimalist, and I think you're going to buy his book in a year or two from now. But it's not the fashion or the curse.
Got one here. Could you say a little bit about what part architecture plays in your writing, please?
Once upon a time, I really would have been good on that. quite a lot. Well, perhaps my previous answer to the thing about teaching and talking about physical space... And talking about making a novel in which everything in the novel has to work and work for you, and so you know that the world is going to be different if the passionate love affair is conducted inside a telephone booth as opposed to a cathedral, for instance. So, you know, if you're to make the world in which your characters exist, then, you know, one can be very interested in what encloses them. In my personal life, I've enjoyed working with architects on a few occasions. I mean, when it came time to worry about how to get that glass church up the river, it was a couple of architects I had lunch with, and they did the calculations. I don't think they're very good calculations, actually, as it turns out, but it doesn't matter in the sense that they're probably credible until you start thinking about it.
There's a question down here.
Hi, you mentioned the other stories, so like the Aboriginal story that's going on in the background. And there's also, when the boat's coming into dock, there's a lovely vignette of a Chinese boatman falling out of his boat. And I just wondered how important those other stories were. It just seemed to me that although that was a tiny little thing, self-contained episode, sort of comedy turn in a way, actually what it's gesturing at is sort of bustling other trade, other immigrants that who have a completely different story.
Yeah, I'd say yes. I think the issue for Australians of European descent in addressing where they live and whose land it might really be is a very, very complicated one. And in a way, it's what Oscar and Lucy, if you want to talk about the things it's about religion, but it's also about this act of killing these stories and replacing them with Christian stories. And it's about possessing a land and destroying its people. And even though I think, like you, we as writers have the moral and artistic responsibility to imagine anybody and anything, yet at the same time, I'm really aware that the Aboriginal people of Australia feel themselves to have perhaps been overinterpreted and invented, and perhaps don't need my help to imagine what it might be like to have been one of their ancestors. So I tried to make the book to be completely illuminated by that fact, at the same time as imagining as little as possible about Indigenous life. And yes, I think I probably would have thought generally about others, in you know, the Chinese particularly. There's a big part of our family history which involved my father working as a chauffeur for a Chinese herbalist, so the family is sort of full of many stories about Chinese in Australia in the early years. So I would lazily, perhaps, or just from, I forget, tend to think that way anyway.
The whole sort of gambling aspect, which is obviously tremendously important. Oscar gambles, or his winnings take him through Oxford. I bought a copy of Oscar and Lucinda for a former member of my family. He was a drunk, and my daughter subsequently kicked him out. But he did almost exactly the same as Oscar, and he was very detailed in keeping notes about horses all over the place.
Yeah.
And whereas, of course, I suppose mostly people who gamble are like you describe in the book, people who just sort of talk to trainers and jockeys and so on, don't do it in any organised way.
Oh, I think a lot of people do it in an organised way, like your disgraceful friend.
Yes, him. Yeah. And do you think this is true in Australia, where I'm from, left long ago, but obviously gambling is a big factor.
I'm sure it's true. Gambling is not something... So it's something I fear I might have a terrible addiction to, but I try and be addicted to other things instead. But I was a little uncertain. You know, the idea in the book leads me to gambling, which I read a lot about and do a lot of research about. And finally, I find a guy who's a psychiatrist who specialises in gambling addiction and has a part share in a racehorse. and read literary books. And he was fabulous. And so when I finished the book in the end, his name was Clive, as I recall, I drove out to Parramatta and I gave the book to him, and he read the book, and I said, so? And at that moment, the writer really wants to be told they're wrong, because in being told you're wrong, then you're looking at the ways you're going to fix it up, and then the book will get more complicated and truer and better and so on. But Clive said, looks pretty right to me.
So there's a lady here.
I was just wondering about how you felt about the book sort of 20 years on. You've mentioned feeling anxious a couple of times in relation to questions. Have I got this wrong? Have I got that wrong? Can you look back on it with pride, or the things you would have changed, or is it affection?
I only really know about the book because of you people. No, I'm serious. I mean, the way I know the book is in hearing and you talking about it. It's a sort of a blur. Sometimes I think it's fantastic, and other times I said to John that I don't read it, but occasionally I might open a bit and look at a page, and if I don't like what I see, then I'm likely to think, well, the book's crap.
It's a very, I mean, writers, I think, do spend most of their life in a state of some considerable anxiety about what they're producing. Maybe they're just anxious people who are drawn to the craft. But it seems foolish to be complacent about it just because, I mean, I did go back and read a very early short story, which I'd been complacent about for 30 years, which I thought was a very good short story, and everybody had told me what a good short story it was. And I went back really merely to correct, to see if I could line edit it, to make it a bit tighter. And I thought it was really, really awful. So that means that, you know, something that I've lived with for 30 years, you know, been congratulating myself on, really I shouldn't congratulate myself on so much. So it's hard to know how to think about these things. But one knows, it's under book, we know. This is a cliche, but we know that the book only lives when somebody reads it. And when you bring your life, which I can't possibly imagine what that is, to that page, you make something with it, and that's when I hear, when people talk about it, that's how I know what the book is, sort of.
Can so. I just pick up the point the lady said, though, because it's quite unusual for a book to have received the acclaim that this book has, and you obviously relish the plot points that you scaled and set yourself as a challenge to tell the story. While you were writing it, and writers, you know, like musicians, think every album's the great one. Mm. Did you have any idea while you were writing this that this was going to be received in the way it has been, and as it says up there, as you know, one of the best of the bookers, which is quite an achievement? And also, did you make plot points in your own writing career with Australia, in the sense that you seem to have moved through the history of Australia quite in a similar manner?
Okay.
With kind of significant books, most recently finishing with Theft and leaving aside your American work.
You know, the funny thing is that when I finished it, no, I didn't at all. And I was very proud of Illiwacha, which was really, was a huge sort of stretch for me, and was not a book that the author of Bliss should have ever thought he could write. So I liked Illiwacha a lot, and I'd been praised enough, you know, to think that I was not wrong to be excited about it. And when I finished Oscar and Lucinda, I think I felt rather... I felt that it was, unlike Illiwacha, which was beyond my range, but came within it, I felt that Oscar and Lucinda was within my range. And that I hadn't really stretched myself sufficiently, and that maybe it was a bit ordinary. That's really what it felt like. So, you know, one slowly gets a notion of one's genius with time. And as for what I've written about or plotting, that, you know, when I finish a book or when I'm near the end of a book, if I have one idea for another book, just an idea, I'm really happy, and that's what I'll start working on. You know, when the idea came to me for this book, and it was to do with this church which was to be taken away and in this little rural community that I lived in, and I started to think it through, and I realised, you know, that I really liked the idea, but it would have to be set in the 19th century. And I fought and kicked. Yeah, I missed so much to find. If I could have had another idea, I would never have written it, because I didn't want to write. I'd never written a novel. Well, Illiwacha said a little bit in the past, but not like this. So there's never two ideas.
I'm thinking about the characters you create. Do you ever revisit them in your mind or in writing again? So there's several characters whose stories are incomplete, like Wardley Fish. Mm. And not that you'd necessarily write about him again, but do you think about his complete story?
Years could go by without me thinking of Wardley Fish. I'm serious.
But we think about him.
Yeah, well, that's different. That's different. I, you know, just to please. I mean, it is 22 years ago. And I don't know how many books I've written since then, but a lot. And when you're involved in actually writing a book, it does occupy, yeah, an awful lot of your mind. So inevitably, I mean, Wardley Fish is not causing me any trouble.
Is
It's not just about him, though. It's you know, say, Lucinda and her further story. It's not that you'd write about them again, but
no,
just...
But you've got these people alive and I hope, luminous in your mind. I haven't anymore. I know, it's terribly... I shouldn't say that either.
But you do tell us, tantalisingly, something about her history afterwards, in a... You say about how she became...
Yeah.
You, because she's left at the end of the novel doing this ghastly job, but she becomes famous in the Australian Labour movement. So she's obviously...
Well, this is my sort of... Yeah. I mean, everyone acts as if there is an end. There's never an end to anything. And there's certainly... There's not an end. You know, this has to be just... To me, that was sort of a relatively important thing. So that's just... This is a chapter of her life. It might be a book called Oscar and Lucinda, but she's going to go off and do a whole lot of other things, and I just wanted to suggest that. And that's within the time of actually writing the book, not in terms of remembering it fondly and sentimentally all these years later. Sorry to be difficult about that.
You said your grandfather always regarded England as home, though he never came here, and you made that fascinating point about landscape, about somehow the green landscape of England was better than the brown landscape or the dried landscape of Australia. Something that resonated strongly with me as a Scot, though I live much nearer, as a kid, I used to come down to England at Easter and think that England was it. Mm. You know, I was living in a second-rate country, a second-rate climate, and a second-rate landscape. And I just wonder, you know, you're seen as an Australian writer, but to what extent do you actually feel rooted in Australia? You've lived in the States for a long time, which fascinates me. Why there? Do you still feel rooted there, or do you feel perhaps because of the colonial experience going back, you're actually pretty mobile?
Are you familiar with the Australian vernacular?
A little bit.
rooted, never mind. I really don't quite know I don't know how to even be approximately truthful about answering the question. But I think one part of it is, you know, I lived in Australia for, 45 years? Almost continuously. Lived here for a couple of years. And you don't forget that for a second. I'm still looking at the United States in that way, yet at the same time within New York particularly, I feel very, very, very at home. Certain aspects of the United States terrifies me. But, you know, certain things about my own country really terrify me. I feel very comfortable being in New York City, but I think I'm an Australian. And I get very irritated with my own country. And it's like your family, you know, when you go back to the wedding or the funeral, whatever it is, and all of those fond feelings and all of those old rages are still there. So I think it's a closer relationship I have with Australia than anything else.
I think we've got time for one more question. I'm going to bring the curtain down, madam.
I really loved the book, and I just kind of wondered how you felt about kind of the ending, and after you'd actually finished writing it, if you felt as bereft as I did.
No, I felt fantastic. I felt really great. Sorry, you haven't finished a question.
No.
Go on.
No, it's fine. No, it's just kind of a feeling like it was just such a privilege to have a window onto those characters, and kind of when it was finished, feeling absolutely lost for days and days, and sort of still feel quite jealous when I sort of realise that someone's reading it for the first time.
Thank you.
Did you mind that Oscar got killed at the very end, and Lucinda lost all her dough, and
maybe you should ask Peter.
No. But I just wondered if being bereft was
no,
also
it wasn't
to do with
so
the...
much. It wasn't so much what happened. It kind of felt like that was the right thing that should have happened, and I love the fact that it was called Oscar and Lucinda.
Do you mean was I?
They didn't end up together.
Was I sorry to have finished writing?
Yes, it was more about the loss of kind of knowing those characters.
You're never sorry to finish, and also, and particularly a book like that, and my new book, *Parrot and Olivia in America*. you have these things about getting the very end to work. And it's really, and for me, it's not, when I get to the end, I'll have written the rest of the book maybe 12, 13, 14 times. But when I arrive at the end, I've never written it. And so, and there's a rather pleasurable terror because you can still screw it up. You know, I mean, maybe what I thought I was bringing everything together, maybe I won't be able to do it. And so one approaches the end in sort of something like, I suppose, the way, you know, ideally, romantically, writers are meant to be all the time, in a sort of a white heat. But it really is like that. And so to reach the end and know that you actually have got to it and that that seems to work is thrilling. It's really, really, really a good feeling. And that happens on that day. What you don't know on that day, of course, is that there's going to be, you know, 6 months of days when you go, but you have to go back and look at this and look at that and look at that, and it isn't really finished, and you're fixing that and you're fixing that and you're sick of it. But that particular day, when you reach that ending, is a lovely day.
Thank you very much. I guess the great thing about good books is when you're bereft, you can go and, after a decent pause, start and read it again, can't you?
Yes.
I would just like to end by just thanking him so much for coming here and talking to us. Thanks very much.